We're doing Parshat Beshalach. We've reached the climax. The Jewish people have been let out. And instead of traveling directly northward, which is the natural path they should have taken from Egypt up to Israel, Hashem takes them a different route. Hashem doesn't want them to face war right away. So Hashem takes them out to the desert. They go eastward. The Jews are exiting Egypt with weapons, chamushim. So why are they taking weapons? What war do they expect? They're going into the desert. You don't walk out into the desert without some kind of weapon. The Jewish people are leaving Egypt. The pasuk says vayasev Elokim et ha'am. The Jerusalem Talmud says on that pasuk vayasev comes from the word hasabah. On Pesach night, we lean on our left as we eat and drink. Vayasev Elokim et ha'am. Hashem made the nation have a mitzvah of leaning. The story of the Exodus from Egypt is going to make us free men who lean when we eat. Hashem says, I don't want them to go directly northward. So there's a very fundamental concept here. The Jewish people are going into Israel, right? What's directly to the north? Directly to the north is a pile of bones. When their brethren, 30 years earlier, as is recorded in Divrei Hayamim, the tribe of Ephraim decided the time has come to leave Mitzrayim, so they got killed. And the Egyptians purposely left their bodies there, so if the Jews ever thought of leaving northward to Israel, they would see all those bodies. So Hashem says, I don't want them to see that. That'll scare them. Hashem just made all these miracles. Hashem can't just make us have a stronger heart. So the answer, as the Ibn Ezra explains, is that Hashem doesn't get involved in that aspect. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz meirat shamayim. Hashem says, your personality development is your job. I can do other things. But in the area of who you are you going to be scared? Are you going to overcome your fears? What you're going to do, that's the challenge I gave you in life. I don't want to be there. I want you to decide. That's our job in this world. Very often people run away from their job in the world. Let the rabbi tell me who to marry. Let the rabbi tell me what job I'm supposed to take. You can consult with them, you can think with them, but at the end of the day, your responsibility as a living being is to reach conclusions. It's good to take advice. David HaMelech also took advice. The Ribbono Shel Olam took counsel before he created the world to teach us we should be open to taking counsel. But at the end of the day, we have to do it. So the Jewish people are leaving Mitzrayim. Everyone was busy getting their stuff together. And one man is busy doing something else. His name is Moshe Rabbeinu. Chacham Levav Yikach Mitzvot. Smart person grabs mitzvos. So Moshe says, we owe it to Yosef to take his bones out of Egypt. But the Egyptians have hidden Yosef's bones. Two opinions in the Talmud. Either they hid him in the pyramids among all the different burial plots of the Egyptian kings so that the Jews could never figure out how to take him out. And then it says Moshe Rabbeinu went into Kabarnitash and Melachim, the Gemara calls it. He went into these huge chasms where they had kings buried, and he said, Yosef, Yosef, the time has come. Hashem's taking us out. Reveal yourself, because if not, we've done ours. And then Yosef's casket started rumbling. So he grabbed it and took it with him. The other opinion says that they buried Yosef in the Nile. They put his casket with lead at the entrance to the Nile, either as a blessing, they believed it would bless the Nile, or so that the Jews could never leave, because the Jews had promised them they would take him out. And here again, we have two Midrashim. One opinion says he came to the Nile and said, Yosef, Yosef, the time has come that Hashem promised to take us out of Egypt. Reveal yourself. And the casket went floating. The other opinion says, when Moshe was in Egypt years earlier, he saw the Jewish babies being put into the mortar and dying. The parents would watch as their children would be squealing to death inside the mortar of the buildings they were building. And Moshe turned to the Ribbono Shel Olam and said, Ribbono Shel Olam, how do you let this happen? And the Ribbono Shel Olam said, when you have an orchard growing, there are thorns. You got to get rid of those thorns. All those babies you see are thorns. It's in their interest and the world's interest that they don't continue living. You think differently. Take a baby out. See what happens with him. So Moshe Rabbeinu pulls a baby out of the mortar. And this baby, his name is going to be Micha. And this baby Micha, Micha Mocha Hashem, yes. The name is supposed to drive him to being a positive, God-fearing person. He must have grown up admiring Moshe. Moshe saved his life. So where Moshe goes, Micha tags along. And when Moshe goes to the Nile, so the casket is buried deep in the Nile. Moshe takes a slither of gold, and he writes on one side, Alei Shor, come up ox. Yosef is called Shor, Bechor Shoro. And on the other side, he writes Hashem's hidden name, and he drops it in the Nile. And up floats Yosef's casket. So he takes the casket, and he goes back to Egypt. Micha lingers around a minute and says, cool, where's that piece of gold? And he finds it, and he pockets it. And a little bit later, when the Jews are in the desert, and Moshe's gone, he's up receiving the Torah, and everyone's thrown in all their gold and silver into a cauldron, into a burning fire. Micha takes the piece of paper that has Hashem's hidden name on it, and says on it, come out ox. And he tosses that into the fire, and out comes an ox. So that starts moving. And back to our parsha. So the poorest person leaving Mitzrayim was Moshe Rabbeinu. Everyone else was busy getting loot, and Moshe was busy getting a mitzvah. And that's the hallmark of leaders of tzaddikim, of the Mashiach. That's why Mashiach is described as a poor man riding on a donkey, just as Moshe Rabbeinu. He wasn't into the money. So Moshe Rabbeinu takes out Yosef's casket. Every other tribe takes out their shevet, his casket. So you had all 12 tribes traveling in the desert in caskets. And they're traveling, and a miracle happens. There's a pillar of cloud that leads them. And at night, before the pillar of cloud disappears, a pillar of fire appears, and then the pillar of cloud goes down. And we will see again and again Hashem's sensitivities to the Jewish people. Hashem could have made the pillar of cloud disappear, and an hour later the pillar of fire appears. Is it so terrible? Eventually it'll come. No, it's a sensitivity. They shouldn't feel for a minute they're alone in the desert. Let the pillar of fire appear first. When I heard that different piguim happened, before my parents knew about it, I would send an SMS, hi mom and dad, hope everything's okay, have a great day. This way they know I'm okay. If I'd write I'm okay, so then they'd say, what happened, right? So now they already know. When they suddenly get an SMS or an email, I hope everything's okay by you guys, everything's great by us, out of the blue, they know something just happened in Israel. We learn from Hashem a sensitivity. Well, you come home and there's a big noise outside. So you could say, you won't believe what just happened out there. And everyone's waiting with a bated breath, wondering if everyone's okay. I'll tell you in a second. But, you know, there was a big noise, and we like teasing people. But Hashem teaches us, no. The pillar of fire appears before the pillar of clouds. And here, Hashem teaches us a sensitivity. Chazal tell us there was an Amora, the Gemara says, named Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef was blind. Couldn't see. And Rav Yosef's wife would light Shabbos candles late. She thought that's the way to light Shabbos candles. So what do you do if your wife lights Shabbos candles and it's already Shabbos? We all know. You start yelling, Shabbos. You tell her how it's wrong. No, that's not what Rav Yosef does, right? Rav Yosef teaches us how to talk to a wife. So what do? You say, honey, there's a clock, there's a calendar, and you see when Shabbos is? So 40 minutes before that, that's when we're supposed to light. No, that's not what Rav Yosef does. How does Rav Yosef talk to his wife? Rav Yosef comes in and tells her, you know, the Jewish people, when they went in the desert, they had a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. And before the pillar of cloud disappeared, along came the pillar of fire so they would have light. And you know what? You're the pillar of fire in our house. You light the candles. You make it a beautiful Shabbos. You make it so light here that you're lighting the candles in honor of Shabbos. But you're supposed to do it the way their Bon Shalom did it. That you light those candles when the sun is still out, before the sun sets, so that we have the pillar of light before the pillar of cloud disappears. That's how he tells her. That's how we know this halacha. That's how we know this. Because the Gemara quotes how Rav Yosef spoke to his wife. So that's, we move on. For 40 years, they're going to travel this way. One thing I don't understand is how any nation dared attack us. A pillar of light, you have a fire, you have a pillar of fire in front of the Jewish people that gives enough light for 2 million people. That's some awesome sight. And that's a very big pillar of fire. You have 2 million people. You guys, you've lit a flashlight at night. You know what it's like to be in the dark. 2 million people need light. That's a big pillar. So people saw that. And if people saw that, then how did they dare attack us? I mean, I don't know, if I'd see that, I'd stay away from the people who have... Make it a laser beam, say whatever you want. It's still a phenomenal sight. I don't know. Yes?
You're saying that the top of the wall, while it's still light outside, it's going down from the pillar of fire?
That's how Rav Yosef told her. Hashem tells Moshe, tell the Jews, we're going back to camp in front of Piachirot. We discussed last week that there was one idol that remained in Egypt. That was this Piachirot. It was two large mountains, one in the shape of the male organ, one in the shape of the female organ, a male and a female mountain. And the Egyptians believed these were two gods, and they believed that these were the gods that prevented slaves from leaving Egypt. So Hashem says, take the Jews back to these mountains. The Egyptians know that every other god in Egypt was destroyed. Every idol, everything they worshipped was destroyed, but these two remained. So they believed that these two must be so powerful that Hashem couldn't touch them. So Hashem says, we're going to bring you back and you'll camp over there. And the Egyptians will believe that... you've come there because you couldn't get out, that their gods forced you back. And then they'll decide to give chase, and then I'll finish him off. Okay. Yes.
How do two idols in the shapes of male and female organs, how do they represent maintaining slavery, I guess?
I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know. So, when the Jews were traveling, the Egyptians had sent along spies, and when 3 days were up, and we weren't returning to Egypt, so then they came back, and Paro said, okay, they're leaving, no good. So Paro gets his chariots, and he takes 600 horsemen, and they start chasing. The Jews have a flag in front of them. They're coming out as a people. That's an important thing, that flag. And the Jews have taken along with them musical instruments. They're going to sing a song, Az Yashir the Shabbos. And that's another important point, that a Jew is always supposed to expect good times. We're always ready to sing. Good things are going to happen. Take along your harmonica. You know. So the Miriam's going to have her tambourine there. Yeah. I don't understand. We sing the Az Yashir. Sure, we sing the Az Yashir. Right, we have a special tune. Ashir and Ashkenazi. I don't know what Sephardim do. Ashkenazim do. We also sing it in the morning davening. I don't know how they do it in shul. I'm saying in the laning. We have a special tune. Okay, so the Egyptians are giving chase. The Jews turn back and they see the Egyptians behind them. They turn to their right and left, they see desert. They look in the front, they see the Yam Suf. They got nowhere to go. And the Egyptians are coming and they're charging and they have their weapons, and the Jews get scared. So Chazal tell us a famous Medrash. Two famous Midrashim. Medrash number one, the king was traveling. And as he's traveling, a princess comes running at him and she says, save me. He looks and there's a group of armed robbers chasing after her. And she runs to the king and he draws his sword. And his men draw their sword and they chase away the armed bandits. And she's so thankful, the princess. He escorts her home. And then a week or two later, he sends her a letter. She doesn't answer. He sends her another one. She doesn't answer. And he sees that she's ignoring him. So the king isn't so happy. Nothing he does can get her to listen. It's a story, a medrash. So the king, he's got a plan. So he hires a bunch of armed robbers. And he tells them, fellas, here's the location. I'm going to be with my men on this side. And when you see her coming out of her house, you come from that side. And you chase her in my direction. And that's what happens. She leaves her house. The armed robbers come. She starts running. Save me, save me. The king comes with his men. And he saves her. And now suddenly she's talking to him again. Chazal say the princess is every one of us. Mm-hmm. When we don't have problems in our life, right, we know what our davening's like. You walk in, you walk out, and we're done. So the Rabbon Shom says, hello. And we're not listening. We're not saying hi. We make the motions. So Hashem sends us problems. And then suddenly our tefillah is a different tefillah. You see, we approach prayer as, I have a problem, so I'm going to pray. And Chazal told us, you didn't pray, so God sent a problem, so you would pray. Meaning Hashem saw that, Chazal taught us that the challenges are so that we would connect. What does Hashem love about the Jewish people? They're davening. When I was a kid, I heard a phenomenal line that's been with me ever since. My best friend's mother said once, a line in passing, she said, I see, we took our own free time, we would learn Chavrusa. On our free time, on Shabbos, we learned, we decided we want to be tzaddikim, we're going to learn. So we went to learn. And on our free time, Sunday afternoon, I'd come to his house, we'd learn. And Shabbos, we'd learn. And one time, his mother just said a comment. She said, I've noticed yeshiva guys, they know how to be tzaddikim and learn more than they have to. I've yet to see a yeshiva guy that knows how to be a tzaddik and daven the way he should. Boom. Wow. That was the line. And she walked on. Wow. And that's been with me ever since, that line. That being a tzaddik is not just about learning more than maybe you're doing in high school. It's also about connecting to Ribbono Shel Olam. What's your tefillah like? So Chazal tell us, what does Hashem love about us? Our tefillah. Yonati b'chagvei ha'sela, the Midrash says, the dove was flying, and the vulture came after it. So the dove goes down, and the vulture comes after it, and it swoops, and the vulture swoops after it. And wherever it goes, the vulture is hot on its tail, until it reaches a crevice in the mountain. And it slowly makes its way into the crevice, and the vulture is hovering outside the crevice, and it can feel its breath on its back, and it looks back, and the vulture can't make it into the crevice. So the dove is breathing a sigh of relief, and the dove looks into the crevice, and it hears a hiss, and it looks into the crevice, and there's a snake approaching it from the inside. So she looks at the snake over there and the vulture behind it. So what does it do? Yonati b'chagvei ha'sela. That's the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs. My dove b'chagvei, in the cracks, ha'sela of the rock, hashmi'ini et kolech. Let me hear your voice. Chazal say, Hashem waits for his dove. He waits for us to make our voice heard in tefillah. So when Am Yisrael is standing there, and the Mitzrim are behind them, and the Yamsuf's in front of them, and the desert is on either side, Hashem says, I was waiting for you, talk to me. Where's your tefillah? So that's why the pasuk says, Ufaro hikriv. What does the word hikriv mean? The word hikriv could mean he came close, or it could mean he brought them closer. Hikriv, he brought Am Yisrael closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Jews turn around, and they see the Egyptian angel above Egypt flying. And they see angels on the Egyptian side coming to fight against them. So they turn to Moshe, and they say a wonderful sarcastic line. They say, was there a shortage of graves in Egypt? You had to bring us out here to die? And so they're about to die, and they could crack a joke. Rav Hirsch writes, that's what Rav Hirsch writes, that's the Jewish thing. In the face, we have to face so much adversity, we have to be able to have humor in the face of adversity. So they tell Moshe, what'd you take us out here for? We thought you had a plan. We told you back in Egypt, leave us alone, because we're better off working for them than dying out in the desert. Moshe says, don't worry. You're going to see Hashem's salvation today. The Egyptian you see today, you're never going to see them again. Hashem yilachem lachem. Hashem is fighting for you. You just have to be quiet. Don't complain about the fact that Hashem took you out of Mitzrayim. So Moshe turns to daven to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And Hashem tells him, what are you davening for? Now's not a time for davening. The Jews are suffering. Deal. This is not a time for your tefillah. So, travel. Ah, there's a Yam Suf. Travel. So Moshe says, Hashem said we should travel because the Yam Suf's going to split. So here we have two Midrashim. We have the famous Midrash your children will come home with from the Cheder that says that Nachshon ben Aminodav from the tribe of Yehuda went into the Yam Suf. And he walked in, everyone said, I'm going to go, and no one did. And Nachshon ben Aminodav went. And he went, and the water reached his knees. It didn't split. And he went, and the water reached his waist. And it didn't split. And he went, and the waters reached his shoulders. And it didn't split. And he continued moving forward till the water reached his nostrils. And he raised his eyes, and he said, Ribon Shalola, more than this I can't do. And at that point, the Yam Suf split. That's the Midrash our children will come home with. The Gemara says a different thing. The Gemara says there was an argument between the tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, who would go first. And Yehuda said, I'm charging. And Binyamin said, I'm charging. And it went back and forth. And then Binyamin went first. According to the Gemara, Binyamin went in first. Yehuda picked up rocks and started throwing it at them. What are you guys doing? Shabbos, right? What are you doing running into the Yam Suf? But Binyamin, according to the Midrash, Binyamin went in first. And Binyamin caused the Yam Suf to split. But according, or Thursday, different opinions. So it was the Shvi Shel Pesach. So according to Gemara, Binyamin is the tribe that went in first. So we say in the Agadah a line that we always forget. In the Agadah it says, whatever the Egyptians suffered in Mitzrayim, they suffered 5 times as much or 25 times as much by the Yam Suf. What does that mean? That means that the night that they're camping behind us, the Egyptians are there and we're here. And the Egyptians are shooting their arrows. They figure, I'm going to hit a Jew one of these arrows. And Hashem has the cloud there so they can't penetrate. And all night long, what happens is wild animals start attacking them. They break out into lice and boils. Their water turns to blood. Their saliva turns to blood. Every one of the 10 plagues happened 5 times worse the night before. And the Egyptians are following the Jews, but they're not giving in. Just in case they forgot the year they had just been through, it is all repeated, only worse. Right now, frogs are jumping into their boots. Grasshoppers are attacking them. Everything that happened in the 10 plagues is happening 5 times worse. And the Egyptians don't give up. And part of what's happening now is Vayaminu Bashem. Am Yisrael makes the choice to say, I know, Ribon Shom, you're running the show. And the Egyptians make the choice to say, I'm not giving in. I'm not letting go. And even though they're getting these blatant reminders, what happened to you this past year? They don't give in. So they're standing there, breaking out into boils, covered with lice. It's pitch dark. They have Makas Choshech all over again. And they're not giving in. So the Jews advance. It's the crack of dawn. The Yam Suf splits. There's been a wind all night long. Rambam says in the Yemenite epistle, Nigeret Teiman, there were people who were arguing that they could figure out astronomically why the Yam Suf was supposed to split that minute. And Rambam says, maybe. But the fact that it split the moment Am Yisrael went in, and it came crashing down the moment the Egyptians went in, that's the miracle. Rambam says, we don't have to say that the way it happened was against nature. Maybe you'll find the natural explanation why it happened. That's fine. The timing is the miracle. That's the answer. Spinoza thought he found something new when Spinoza said, people notice the splitting of the sea and they forget the pasuk that says that all night long the winds went against the sea. That was Spinoza's line. He said, there's a verse there everyone ignores. Rambam didn't ignore it. Spinoza wasn't the first to notice this. Rambam says there might be a natural explanation and it doesn't bother us. It's the timing that's the miracle. We know Rambam, Maimonides, explains many midrashim in a natural way. But here, Rambam goes with the Medrash. The Medrash, we have the Mishnah in the end of Pirkei Avot. Right? Chapter 5 of Pirkei Avot is filled with numbers. Yes? 10 generations from Adam to Noah. 10 generations from Noah to Avram. 7 traits to a golem. 7 traits to a wise man. Right? The Mishnah goes through 3 traits to the disciple of Avram Avinu. 3 traits to the disciple of Bilam the Wicked. The 5th chapter gives numbers. So it's a chapter filled with numbers. One of the Mishnayos there says 10 miracles happened to our forefathers by the Yamsuf. And Rambam over there brings the Medrash. When they crossed the Yamsuf, so we know Rambam's opinion, right? That the way they crossed the Yamsuf was like a rainbow. They went in here, and they came back out on the same side, right? 12, it says there were 12 paths for each tribe, so they went in like this. But each tribe had their own path, they came out on the same side. They came out on the Egyptian side. It was just a way to get the Egyptians into the Yamsuf and have the Yamsuf collapse on them. But we went in and back out. We didn't cross.
They separated.
Why were they separated into 12 tribes? I don't know, but the Medrash says we were divided into 12 tribes. The Medrash says the land under us was solid. When the Egyptians came in, they couldn't walk on the land. The Medrash says the walls had fruits growing. They could pluck fruits as they were going. The Medrash says it was like glass walls. They could wave to one another as they were going through. They could see the other tribes going as well. And again, Rambam, who takes many Midrashim and says, don't take that literally. There's a rational explanation. On this one, he goes verbatim with the Medrash. All 10 miracles, Rambam says that's what happened. Yes, sir. Semicircle. We came back to the same side.
We walked and came back the same path.
Not the same path. We went in, went around, came back out. If this is the Yamsuf,
yeah.
So we went into the sea and came back out the same side we had gone in. We did like a U-turn.
A little detour, basically.
A U-turn into the sea.
Maybe
this is the one. He might be a visual learner.
Sure. This whole cup of tea is the Yamsuf. Okay? The Jews come in here. They're in the Yamsuf. And then they come back out of the Yamsuf over here on the same side. They came in on the Egyptian side, walked through the Yamsuf for a journey, and then came back out of the Yamsuf out here. Only a longer path.
Not okay. But what's the point of coming back on the same side of the world?
So you see that the whole splitting of the sea was not about getting to the other side. It was about getting the Mitzrayim in, right? We would have the miracle. And here we have a Midrash that when the Jewish people entered the Yamsuf, they saw how Hashem runs the world. They had a better picture than the prophet Yechezkel ben Buzi. So you read that, and if you read it on a fifth grade level, you understand, wow, they saw chariots of fire. They saw heavenly visions, right? But is that what it means? Or does it mean that they had to look back on all their suffering? They had to look at, why does Hashem do this in the world? Why is there a world where people die and people suffer? They had to understand what's going on. And when they saw the miracle of the splitting of the sea, they were able to see an element of clarity into how Hashem runs the world, what the Talmud calls Maisa Merkava. They're able to understand about how Hashem runs the world more than even prophets would understand later. Now you'll ask me, what did they understand? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know what answer they got. I still have the questions, right? So we have some answers, but we don't have the answers they received. But they were able to understand. They had a better picture of how Hashem runs the world than we do, and it was prophetic. Meaning the Gemara says, even the babies understood. It says even the maids, everyone understood. Everyone had prophetic vision that was greater than the Navi Yechezkel. So it was prophetic. It wasn't like an epiphany, aha. No, there was something prophetic going on here. And here we have the famous commentary of the Rashba. We know in Spain, the chief rabbi was Nachmanides, the Ramban, right? Nachmanides, the doctor, who would argue a lot with Rambam, Maimonides. So one of his top disciples was the Rashba. The Rashba became chief rabbi after the Ramban. And the Rashba has commentary on Talmud, and he also has responsa. So in his responsa, he asks, does Hashem make miracles that contradict logic? He says, Hashem makes miracles that are extraordinary, but they don't contradict logic. Meaning, Hashem will not make it that if you have a 90 degree triangle, the hypotenuse will be shorter than one of the sides. That contradicts logic. So when Hashem makes miracles, Hashem takes the range of the world and makes something extraordinary happen. But He will not do something that contradicts logic. Says the Rashba, the idea that every person has prophecy is extraordinary. How does everyone get to that level? But it's not contradictory to logic. It's within our potential. I can get there if I work really hard. Maybe I'll get there. But it's not like making a person doing something which defies logic. Like, that's the Rashba's definition about miracles. Okay, so I don't know if it defies logic. I'll give you an example. If at that moment a comet flew by with a magnetic field, if at that moment there were a lot of stars that were directly positioned, which is what they argued in the Yemenite epistle, positioned in a way that their magnetic pull focused there. Could happen. I don't know how to say more than that. Okay, so we walk into the Yam Suf, and yes. That's a great question. I don't know. That's a very good question. I want to look inside. I don't know. Rabbi Yeshua Ibn Shu'ib, his student, quotes this response in his commentary on this week's parasha. We have to check. It's a very good question. Wow, knockout. I don't know. Got to look it up. I don't know. It could be he addresses it. I didn't review the full thing today, so I don't remember every detail. I don't know. So the Egyptians charged the Yam Suf. There are multiple opinions among the commentaries what happened here. One opinion says it was dark, and so they didn't even know they were entering the Yam Suf till it was too late. The other opinion says, no, look at how wicked they were. Down to the last minute, they're not giving in. The Medrash says in the Pasuk of Shir Hashirim, L'susati b'rechvei farod dimiticha ayati, the Medrash says, the Ribon Shalom appeared by the Yam Suf like a female horse. And Paro's horse saw this female horse ahead and got very excited, so charged. Paro and the Egyptians were standing by the Yam Suf seeing this miracle, uncertain, what do we do now? But then Paro's horse got the better of him and charged for that female horse he thought he saw. And he's running. And Paro's men behind him, they see Paro charge, they're after him. So they charge into the Yam Suf. And at the crack of dawn, turmoil hits the Egyptian camp. And their wheels start coming off of their chariots. And their horses' feet get caught in the mud. And things start turning bad. And the Egyptians say, oh no, Hashem is fighting us. And this is the first time the Egyptians are willing to recognize Hashem is fighting us. And at that point, Hashem tells Moshe, raise your staff over the Yam Suf. The Jews have just come out. And let the waters come crashing down on the Egyptians. So now that the Jews have come out of the Yam Suf, Moshe raises his hand with the staff over the Yam Suf, and it comes crashing down. And the Egyptians, those who were more pious, they were killed like a piece of lead. They died. Those who were more wicked, they were tossed back and forth until they died. And the Jews come out on the dry land, and some Jews start saying, well, we're back on the Egyptian side. The Egyptians are just further down the sea. They detoured. They're on that side. In a few minutes, they're going to catch up with us all over again. So there were Jews who were saying, the Egyptians are alive and well. So Hashem asked the sea, the Yam Suf, give out the bodies. Let the Jews see the bodies of their Egyptian masters dead on the bay. And that's why the song only begins after the bodies were washed ashore. Only then, Az Yashil, then the Jews started singing. Because until then they weren't calm. Until they walked and they saw Muhammad, their former slave driver, lying there dead, they weren't ready to give song. They were wondering, is he still going to catch up to me? When they saw their masters dead, then they believed in Hashem, and they believed Moshe was really his messenger, and they gave the song of Az Yashil. Okay, so the song, we'll quickly go through a definition of the song. Moshe sings and the Jews repeat after him. I will sing to Hashem because he has gone above the most arrogant. Egypt was known for its arrogance, right? They said they created themselves, no one could take them down. Hashem showed them he's really the boss. Hashem tossed them, the horseman couldn't release himself from the horse. Meaning what they saw when the waters were crashing down on them was man and horse being thrown in every direction. The men were attached to their horses. The strength and the song go to Hashem because he has been my salvation. Ze eli ve'anveyu. This is the focus of the song. Hashem, ze, they pointed. They said, now we can see Hashem's hand in our life. Ve'anveyu, I will beautify him. From here we have the mitzvah of making beautiful things, making our mitzvot beautiful. Buy a beautiful etrog, right? Beautiful things in mitzvot comes from the pasuk Zeke Levan Veil. This is my God, I will beautify him. I will do beautiful mitzvot before him. Every mitzvah we do, we try to do in a beautiful way. The anveyu also means I will build him a naveh. The anveyu from the word naveh. What does naveh mean? Nave means a home. The anveyu, I will build him a home. So the Jewish people have just accepted they will build the Beit HaMikdash. Elokei Avi, Hashem is the God of my fathers, and I will exalt him. Hashem is the man of war. The Egyptians thought they control war. Hashem controls war. It says that the Jews saw Hashem, when they looked back, what they saw was a vision of a huge warrior. Meaning the Egyptians saw a horse. They charged towards the horse. The Jews saw a man of war. Hashem is merciful at the same time that he fights a war. He could be fighting against the Egyptians and being merciful to us at the same time. Hashem threw down Paro and his chariots, and even his most chosen men were tossed in the Yam Suf, covered by the depths. They went down like a rock. Hashem, your right hand is amazing in its strength and how it bashes the enemy. And all who arise against you, you knock down. Your anger consumes them like fire consumes hay. And you and your anger could make the waters be smart. The waters became so smart that now they knew not to crash on the Jews, yes, to crash on the Egyptians. They became solid, even though they were liquid. At the Dead Sea, suddenly you had solid pillars. The waters don't come down at us. The enemy said, let me chase them and catch up to them. So Pashup Shad is, that's talking about Paro. Others say these were other enemies. Other nations said, let me catch up to the Jews. I'll get a lot of loot. What? Which mitzvah? Okay. Paro said, I'm going to draw my sword and I'll wipe him out with it. And look, Hashem, you just blew at them and the water destroyed them. They went down like lead. Mi chamocha, who is like you, powerful Hashem? Who is like you, awesome in his might? You do wondrous things. And the Medrash says that the Egyptian bodies were swallowed into the sand. after the Jews came to them. So Moshe Rabbeinu wanted the Jews to leave the Yamsuf, and the Jews didn't want to leave. What were they busy doing? Pulling gold teeth, taking off chains. They said, we can make money here. So the Jews didn't want to leave Yamsuf. So so Hashem made it that the Egyptians got swallowed into the ground. All the nations got really scared because they heard the Jews were headed to Israel. So they got scared. Hashem's showing up on the scene. He's on their side. What are we going to do? We conclude the song. We say, Mikedash Hashem konenu yadecha. We want to build the Beit HaMikdash. Ribon Shalom, we want to build your temple, and you should give it a foundation. Okay, Miriam leads the women in song, and Moshe pulls the Jews out of the Yamsuf. And the Jews are traveling like a group of bandits, right? There's no law, there's no order, there's no Torah, there's nothing. They're traveling 3 days in the desert, and they come to a place called Mara. And in Mara, the pasuk says they couldn't drink the waters were bitter, that's why they called it Mara. Our sages say they didn't have a shortage of water, that wasn't the problem. Water over here is a reference to Torah. Moshe tries teaching them Torah, and they were too embittered to learn Torah. It says the Jewish people coming out of the Yamsuf looked like a bunch of invalids. Everyone was wounded. This guy was missing a leg. That guy was missing an eye. The Jews coming out of Mitzrayim were all wounded. They were all beaten up from the years of slavery. So now everything's over. The dust settled. We're free. But they look back at all the relatives they lost at Choshech. They look back at 210 years of suffering. And now Moshe's trying to teach them Torah. And it's not working. They're not prepared to hear Torah. They couldn't drink the waters of Mara because the Jews were bitter. The Jews had come into the desert, now they were embittered. And so Moshe couldn't teach them Torah. So they come to Moshe and they're complaining. And Moshe calls Hashem, and Hashem says, here's a stick, throw it in the water and it will sweeten the waters. What does that mean? So if we're talking about waters, so Chazal say Hashem showed him a bitter tree, and Hashem said, put that in the waters, and the waters will become sweet. And that's why Hashem does miracles. When Chizkio has a boil, the worst thing for the boil is to put on it figs. The figs are wet, and the boil's wet, and you want to dry it out, and it doesn't work. And Hashem says, put the figs, that's how it'll get cured. So over here, that's why it's interesting. Today they're trying to research using figs to cure cancer because of the pasuk that says that figs cured some kind of killing lethal boil that Chizkio had. But coming back to here, so Chazal say it was the opposite. Hashem took something that shouldn't have worked and said, here, I'll show you that it can work. So what's going on here? So if we take the middle ground is between the two midrashim is a third opinion. The third opinion says the Jews said, okay, we're out in the desert. We're supposed to serve Hashem. But this is scary business. All we've seen Hashem do is punish and kill. What did he do? He hurt the Egyptians. He killed their families. So now he's our boss, right? They were scared. They looked at it and they said, this is a scary business to serve Hashem. We do one thing wrong and boom, we'll get zapped. And so that's why the first miracle Hashem does for the Jewish people as a personal miracle out in the desert is Hashem cures the waters. He makes the waters sweet. Hashem says, don't worry. You do what you're supposed to. Nothing of what you saw in Egypt will happen to you. And so here, some commentaries say that every type of illness happened in Egypt, and that's why, till today, there are people that if they get ill or something, they'll say this pasuk. There are people who have this pasuk hanging over their door. All the illnesses I put on the Egyptians won't come to you. I am Hashem, your healer. So this wasn't many amulets over the generations. This is what the Talmud says. They used to, when they put bombs on a wound, they would spit, and then the saliva would mix with the bomb. So what they would do is, they'd spit, and then they'd say the pasuk as they'd mix in the bomb. So the Gemara says, a person has no portion in the world to come if he does that. You're spitting as you're saying a pasuk? What does it look like? You spit and then you say the pasuk. Doesn't look nice. So Talmud says you're not allowed to do that.
I just want to say that people spit on the ground when they're talking about idol worship. Is that... Why would they do that?
I've never seen that.
I've seen it in...
Chabad, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Ask them. I don't know. I remember when you said it. I remember once years ago I was in a Chabad shul, and I remember
in the shul, the spit on the ground.
Right.
Spitting on the ground while praying
in the shul.
You have to remember that in once upon a time. I know this sounds foreign to you, but once upon a time they didn't have tissues. This was a reality up until when I was a kid. It was the rich kids in class that had tissues. Everyone else had handkerchiefs. Okay, I grew up with handkerchiefs. I didn't grow up with tissues. Who could afford tissues? So, I know today it sounds like you get free tissues there, free tissues here. Once upon a time, it wasn't like that. So, in ancient times, not so long ago, people spat in shul all the time. It says in Halacha that just cover it up. But you couldn't tell people not to spit. They had phlegm. They didn't have tissues. What were they supposed to do? You're going to send them out of shul every time they have to... This is a part of life. You know, we
need to be able to spit.
In their days, yeah. Don't forget, their floor was dirt. They'd spit and cover it. So it says you're not supposed to do it as you say a pasuk. You're not supposed to do it as you pray, right? But people did it. It was, yeah.
It's a rule.
Yeah.
Not allowed to swallow it if you haven't spit. And when the shul was richer, they had 2,000 things where you could spit in. I don't even know the Dutch word for it, but all shuls in Holland still have them.
Yeah. Okay.
Bispador.
So the Jews come complaining and they say we're going to die of hunger, and Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to make it rain bread, and they'll gather their bread every day, and on Friday they'll get a double portion, and the Jews are told this is what's going to happen. So this thing comes down, there's dew on the bottom, and then there's this wondrous bread and another layer of dew on top. It comes in like a box. So first of all, we see aesthetics, right? Hashem could have made the man just fall on the ground. No, there's a layer beneath it, there's a layer above it. The halacha says when we come to eat bread on Shabbos, we commemorate the man and the double portion of the man on Shabbos, and that's why we should have some kind of tablecloth or napkin under the challahs and another tablecloth or napkin over the challahs. So today, everyone has a challah cutting board and a challah cover, but really, you could have a napkin beneath it and a napkin over it. The idea is it shouldn't be on the table. You could put it on a plate, right? You put it on a plate, that's the layer beneath it. You put another plate over it, that's the layer over it. You come to make hamotzi, some have the custom that they hold the challahs under the cover. My custom, the Ekish custom, is that you remove the cover and then you make the blessing. So we prepare the challahs that way. Every meal you have on Shabbos, you should have 2 loaves of bread. If you're traveling, you ran out of bread, so let them eat cake and eat 2 loaves of cake, yes? If you have, or at least make amotzi on the 2 loaves of cake, right? That's if you don't have 2 loaves of bread. If you're having a family simcha and you're eating 5 meals, right? You eat the nighttime meal, you get up in the morning, you eat the morning meal, then you have kiddush, you eat a second meal, then you have sudash shishit, you have a third meal, then you decide you're hungry, you're having a 4th meal. So every meal, ideally, you should make amotzi every time you're having a meal on 2 loaves of bread. You're allowed to snack, you could eat ragalach, you could eat fruits. But if you're eating a meal, so don't make a motzi on a sandwich. Make a motzi on 2 loaves of bread. Every meal, at least for Ashkenazim. That's the Amorites. Let's hold off on questions. We got 3 minutes and we didn't finish the parasha. So we make a motzi on Lechem Mishneh every one of the meals to commemorate the man. Ancient custom was that you make homemade bread. That's if you can make homemade bread. Most people today, it's very hard. It takes a lot of time. It's easier to buy angel's bread, and it might even be more delicious. Don't tell your wives that. But yeah, angel's bread has 50 ingredients or something, right? So if your wife can do it, it's a nice thing. But so we have this amazing thing that if you leave over any bread for tomorrow, it rots. On Friday, it'll last 2 days. But from Sunday, if you hold off to Monday, it rots. Now, human nature is you got 5 kids. So you have 7 mouths to feed. You, your wife, and your kids. You go out and collect the mun. You're not going to finish it all today. You're going to hold some on for tomorrow. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? No. You have to finish it all today. Chazal say for 40 years in the desert, the Jews felt tortured by this. On the one hand, they have a gift. They're getting free bread. On the other hand, they never have tomorrow's bread when they go to sleep at night. It's a pretty difficult thing. Every morning, you have to find out. So we like confidence. When you show up to a meal and they set the table and everything's before you, so then you enjoy eating the meal. But if they bring out this little bowl of salad and then they bring out a little bowl of rice and you don't know that there's a lot of other courses coming. So every time you look at it, you don't know how much you're going to get to eat. So Chazal say Hashem gave this to us because this developed a connection with the Ribon Shel Olam. That living a life where you didn't know what you and your children would eat tomorrow made the Jewish people a different people. Hashem said, after you went through 40 years of that, you're connected to me in a way that will last you forever. That created a bond between us. But it was torture. The Pasuk calls it, Lemana Notecha. I gave you a difficulty. It's a difficult life going to sleep at night not knowing what you're eating the next morning. The Talmud says, why do couples fight? One of the main reasons the Talmud says couples fight is because the wife doesn't have confidence that she'll have what to eat tomorrow. En k'tata metzuya beveito shel adam ela bishvil chitim. The Gemara says fighting is primarily when a person doesn't feel confident that they have food, that they have a good sustenance, that they're going to have a roof over their head. So there's an idea of giving a person a feeling of confidence, knowing we have a savings account. There are things we do in a marriage that gives a person a feeling like they have confidence. One of the mistakes couples make is that they don't designate a night that they're together. If a wife knows that every week on Tuesday night we're together, and I'm not only talking about the act of intimacy, it's a date night. The idea, I'll have time with you. We recommend when couples get married the first year, every night you should eat dinner together. There should be one meal the wife knows I'll be able to share with you what's going on in my life. Some couples can do it breakfast, some couples can do it lunch, some couples can do it dinner. There's a kindness. You remember we discussed in the beginning that Hashem was kind to us. The pillar of fire comes up before the pillar of cloud goes down. There's a kindness in a relationship. When we know we're going to have our needs taken care of, then we're more comfortable as time goes on. And that's why the halacha says that a couple has times that you're obligated. You're going on a journey, you owe it to your wife to be intimate the night before. You came back from a journey, you owe it to her to be intimate that night. Why is that important? She knows she'll have you. There's a need we have. We need to know we have. There are certain things we need to know. A person can live his life better when he knows he'll get it. That's why we recommend set up a date night. I'm shocked. I encountered this again this past month. Time and again, most recently this week, I met with an alumni of our Mahon, and I asked the couple, I said, when's your date night? And they looked at me and they were like, we finished dating, we're married. And they both gave me that answer. And I mentioned it in our Sunday class, I'm mentioning it again, it's wrong. You want to build a good relationship, set up a night that she knows you're going to have time together, you're going to go out together. It doesn't have to be expensive, it has to be time. That's the idea also why the halacha says, we don't have time to go into it, but that's the idea why the halacha says that the night a woman goes to mikvah, so that's the night they're getting back together again, the halacha says you're not supposed to have guests that night. You're supposed to be together, only us. What difference does it make? So we discussed this Gemara, we're out of time, that the Gemara says a woman doesn't feel the same having a conversation with you when someone else is in the room. It doesn't matter that it's her brother, it's her father, it doesn't matter, you're supposed to be alone. Hashem gives us the man in a way that's counterintuitive, it's not the way we would expect. It develops within us a feeling of being, we need Hashem, but Chazal saw a need to explain it, because it's not the way Hashem deals with us ordinarily. It was a unique thing that Hashem said that generation needed it, and that's why that generation would only get food for that day. We have to pick up, if you guys want, on Friday, we'll take 20 minutes. We have to discuss what was the man. We have to discuss why on this Shabbos we take out food for the birds, and a little bit of the halachas of why we take it out before Shabbos and not on Shabbos, and finally the war with Amalek. So we have a few more topics we didn't get to touch on. The idea of why the nations are always challenging us over Jerusalem is also in our parsha. So we will visit that Bezat Shem if we can Friday morning. We'll take maybe 20 minutes. We'll try to finish off the parsha because Thursday night we're all out at a wedding. So we'll meet again Bezat Shem Friday morning at 9 o'clock.